Well, hello there. Welcome back to the Psychology of Learning. Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, whenever you're listening to this. I'm going to go through the slides today that are labeled 1-MAR23. These are the lectures for the week starting March 23rd. You'll see that I've put our new schedule into these slides. We've got quite a lot of reorganization that we've done. So if you haven't had a chance to look all the way through that long message I sent you, go ahead back and have a look at that, because it gives you some important information on how we're going to proceed, what your assignments are going to be, how they're going to be different, if at all, and what you should expect to hear from me week to week. This week, our first and main goal is to talk through the two basic topics of discrimination and peak shift. And we'll talk about discrimination through a related and essentially opposite concept that is generalization. So for the first hour here, or the first recording, we'll see how it shakes out. The goal is that you'll be able to predict the presence of excitatory and inhibitory stimulus generalization gradients. So we'll talk about what they are, and we'll talk about the situations that cause each one, and hopefully get you to the place where you feel like you could differentiate the two. And then we'll talk about the peak shift phenomenon, which is a really interesting thing that happens with certain stimulus generalization gradients, and we'll talk about why we think it happens, what some of the theories are that are out there. So the task of identifying and differentiating various stimuli, especially within the relatively complicated environment that most animals find themselves in most of the time, turns out to not be a simple matter. Stimuli can be defined in all kinds of ways, and so identifying and differentiating them for researchers can also be somewhat challenging. Sometimes really widely different objects or events are considered instances of the same stimulus, and that is typically the case when they all share the same function. A wheel, for example, can be small, large, spoked, not spoked. It can be made of wood, rubber, or metal, but it's still a wheel. So in other words, these different types of wheels are very different from one another, but they all perform the same function. And so by contrast, stimuli in other cases can be identified and distinguished very simply in terms of, and easily, in terms of precise physical features like wavelength of light or the frequency of their radio waves. Think about, like, if you listen to a particular station, a particular radio station, if you use your radio, and you have to tune your radio within a very small range on the FM band, otherwise you'll hear from some other station, or you'll hear some interference, you hear static, in addition to the station you're looking for. In that case, a really small variation in the stimulus can significantly change the outcome, that is, the quality of the reception. Psychologists and physiologists have been trying to figure out how organisms do this relatively difficult task for a very long time, it turns out, this task of identifying and distinguishing different stimuli. How do you tell one from another? How do you tell that two instances of stimuli that might be quite different physically are actually the same one? There's two different challenges here, two almost opposite challenges. Some people have suggested that this might be the single most important question in psychology. The suggestion was made by Stevens first in 1951. And whether you or anyone else agrees or disagrees with Stevens, this problem is definitely central to our analysis of stimulus control. Because in addition to stimulus discrimination and differential responding, we have to be aware of stimulus generalization. Again, these are two opposites of the same coin. So what we'll be looking for is, we'll call some scenario as a scenario that shows stimulus generalization if an organism responds in a similar fashion to two or more stimuli. This phenomenon, as many we've talked about, was first observed by Pavlov. After one stimulus was used as a conditioned stimulus, he saw that his dogs would also make a conditioned response to other similar stimuli, meaning that if you trained them to respond to a bell and expect food after the bell, you could ring a similar bell, right after or in a totally different trial, and the dogs might very well respond to that bell as well. So we'd call that generalization. If you had a bell that tinkles and the dogs respond to the tinkle bell, and you find a larger one that tonkles, dogs respond to the tonkle bell just as much. They're showing what we call stimulus generalization. Another way to say that would be that the dogs failed to respond differentially to stimuli that were similar to the original condition stimulus. You could argue that they should not have responded to the tonkle bell because they were trained that the tinkle bell is the one that was followed by food. But because they didn't, we say that they showed an instance of generalization. Generalization was also shown in a landmark study in instrumental conditioning in the 50s by Gutman and Kalish. They first reinforced pigeons on a variable interval schedule for pecking by illuminating a yellowish-orange light with a physical light wavelength of 580 nanometers. And after training, the birds were tested with a variety of other colors similar to the yellowish-orange they were originally shown, presented in a random order and without reinforcement, and they recorded the rate of responding for each color. And so if you skip to the next slide here, the first slide with a graph in our set, slide 6, you're going to see the results of that study. The birds had a high rate of pecking to the original color, of course, so you can see that at the x-axis value of 580 nanometers, but they also pecked a lot when they were shown a light that reflected at a wavelength of 570 nanometers and one at a wavelength of 590 nanometers. But then, as the color of the test stimulus got increasingly different from the original color, the birds pecked less and less. And so this gradient of responding, this really high value at the original stimulus, paired with similar lower, but also relatively high values at closely similar stimuli, then dropping off after that, is what's known as a stimulus generalization gradient. If you're feeling super lost with the idea of nanometers of wavelengths of light, it might be a good idea to pause this recording and Google that and have a look at the general light distribution gradient and see that different nanometers of wavelength in light energy leads to different colors in the visible spectrum. So get a good feeling of that before you go forward if you're unclear on that so far. So a stimulus generalization gradient like this one can be used to measure stimulus control, and in fact that's often done because it provides the researcher with information about how sensitive the organism's behavior is to variations in a particular aspect of the environment. With the use of gradients like these, we can figure out exactly how much a stimulus has to be altered to produce a change in behavior. So consider the two different gradients in the graphs on the following slide here. In the original, we see that the gradient shows us that the wavelength needs to be changed by more than 10 nanometers from the original color of the light for the pigeon to realize that there's been some change in the color. They won't notice it at first. They'll generalize to those nearest values, but they won't generalize much further than that. Now on the bottom here, we're looking at a very different graph that answers the question, how do you think colorblind pigeons might have responded to this different colored light experiment? And so they didn't actually test this, but there's hypothetical results on this, again, on this second lower graph here. If they couldn't respond on the basis of color, the pigeons would just see the light being on or off, and so they should respond just as often to a light of any color. They would only know that it was on, and they'd have what we call a flat gradient. So comparing Gutman and Kalish's actual results to the hypothetical colorblind data introduces the idea to us that the steepness of a stimulus generalization gradient gives us a precise measure of the degree of stimulus control. And so when we say stimulus control, we're referring to the control the stimulus has over behavior. And so in this case, we see that for pigeons who can see color, the Color of the light has quite a lot of control over the behavior. But for colorblind pigeons, the color of the light would, very sensibly, have almost no control over their behavior. The steep gradient shows us differential responding and discrimination, high control, and a flat gradient shows us no differential responding, and in fact shows us generalization rather than discrimination. So that's a low degree of control. And stimulus generalization, as a general topic, is crucial in a number of different avenues, and one in particular is behavior therapy. Like other forms of therapy, behavior therapy is done in really specific circumstances. You sit in a therapist's office in a lot of cases, and the experience of going through that therapy and maybe practicing certain behaviors or certain thought processes is done in that really controlled environment with that one particular person. So for a treatment like that to be useful, what's learned during the treatment period needs to be used outside that treatment situation, out in that person's everyday life, out in their real world. In other words, the things they learn have to generalize. Think of, for example, a child with autism who's taught certain communicative responses in an interaction with their therapist. We also want them to use those responses, to use the tools their therapist gives them in interactions with other people, in interactions at school, interactions with other adults, and so on. And so we need that child to generalize their learning. So there are a couple of techniques that researchers have proposed to try to facilitate generalization of treatment outcomes. They don't always fit perfectly together, but I want to take you through all of them. The first one is that the treatment situation should be made as similar as possible to the natural environment of the client. For example, if the natural environment provides reinforcement only here and there intermittently, then it's a good idea to reduce the frequency of reinforcement during treatment sessions as well. If the child isn't going to, let's stick with our example of a child with autism. If they're not going to receive a particular kind of, let's say, positive feedback in a conversation with a peer, like if other children aren't always going to be saying, thank you for telling me about your emotion in this situation, you might not want to do that in the therapy situation either. You might want to create a kind of feedback that's going to be a little more natural to them. And that leads me right into the second part of number one. We need the reinforcers themselves to be the kinds of things that the client is likely to encounter naturally. Second suggestion, we should conduct the treatment procedure in new settings. It's called sequential modification in sort of a terminological sense, but basically if you condition a behavior in one situation, let's say a classroom, your next instance of training would be best conducted in a new situation, a new place, like say a playground, or maybe in an office somewhere. And if that second instance of training in a different situation, a different place, doesn't result in enough generalization, you can then go on and extend your training to other environments. So move from a classroom to a playground, maybe to home, the child's home, and then after that to some other environment, to the grocery store, anything in between. Third thing we can do is use numerous exemplars during training. So if you're trying to, let's say, extinguish somebody's fear of elevators, you're going to want to conduct training sessions with them with various types of elevators. You want to put them in a really safe-feeling, really smooth elevator. You might want to put them in a more rickety elevator. You're going to want to put them in a fast and a slow elevator, a newer and an older elevator, a really clean and a really dirty elevator, so that all those different exemplars can combine to create generalization. Fourth thing we can do is condition the new response to stimuli that are common to various situations. So language gives us a pretty effective mediator here. You can just sort of explain to most people how it's possible that a new response to a stimulus might be useful in other situations. Handy that we are just able to talk to each other. So this is a solution that wouldn't be effective if we were trying to lead generalization in animals. But the response condition to a verbal or an instructional cue is also going to be likely to generalize to a new situation where those same instructional stimuli are encountered. So if you give, let's go back to our child with autism, if you give them a certain instruction for how to complete a particular task in therapy, it would be helpful if they get those exact same instructions when they then have to do that same task in the classroom. So you as the therapist would probably try to find out what is said in the classroom so you could say it in therapy. Fifth suggestion, make the training procedure indiscriminable or incidental to other activities. When we know we're being trained, we know that the training is a sort of event in itself. But if you can slip it in kind of naturally, then you can almost fool the person to believe that they're doing normal natural behavior. So in one study done by McGee and colleagues in 86, the investigators took advantage of the interest that a group of children with autism showed in specific toys. One of the hallmarks of an autism diagnosis is typically an area of extreme interest. So what McGee and colleagues did was use the toy that child was particularly interested in a play session to teach the children how to read. They were having them read the names of the toys. And so that combination of doing something the child really liked, along with doing something that the therapist wanted them to learn, led to a sort of naturalistic learning environment. Sixth and last suggestion is that generalization outside a training session can be achieved if the training helps bring the individual into contact with the contingencies of reinforcement, so the specific schedule of reinforcement that's available in the natural environment, or that is the natural environment, what those natural contingencies are. Once a response is required through some kind of special training, you can usually maintain that response with those then naturally available reinforcers. So think about like riding a bike is a really nice example here. Riding a bike has a series of small skills that you have to learn as you figure it out. And then once you've got the whole constellation of skills together, the reinforcement you get is that you can ride the bike now. It moves. It goes. You get on it and you pedal it and you balance yourself and it moves forward. So it is a self-reinforcing a piece of learning after that. Reading is the same, arithmetic is the same. The ability to do the thing provides as reinforcement of all the previous lessons. So back to the concept of generalization as far as psychology of learning is concerned. Pavlov suggested that stimulus generalization occurs because learning about a conditioned stimulus becomes transferred to some other stimuli on the basis of physical similarity, that being the similarity of those test stimuli to the original conditioned stimulus. Lashley and Wade took exception to this proposal. It was a very spicy debate in the literature in the middle of the 1900s. They rejected the idea that generalization reflects the transfer of learning, and they argued that in fact it reflects the absence of learning. In particular, they proposed that stimulus generalization occurs if organisms have not yet learned to distinguish the differences among stimuli. Pavlov said it shows that the animal understands the stimulus and recognizes similar stimuli. Lashley and Wade said, no, this suggests this idea of generalization or the presence of it suggests that animals don't understand the stimulus itself. They hear some or see some similar stimulus and mistake it for the original. So our earlier example of dogs responding to two different bells aren't showing that they know that the general idea of a bell is predictive of oncoming food, but in fact that they don't know the difference between those two bells. They haven't figured out that the tinkle bell means food is coming and the tonkle bell is just a different bell. So Lashley and Wade said animals have to learn to treat stimuli as different from one another in order to show real and true learning. So the chief difference here is that the shape of a stimulus generalization gradient wouldn't be determined by the stimulus, as Pavlov may have thought, but according to Lashley and Wade, would be determined by the organism's previous learning experiences, rather than the physical properties of the stimulus itself. And it turns out that they were not quite right, but they were definitely closer to the truth than Pavlov was. We've seen lots of studies since the 50s that have shown that stimulus control can be dramatically altered by learning experiences in the past of the animal. And perhaps the most powerful procedure for bringing behavior under the control of a stimulus is called stimulus discrimination training. In a procedure like this, participants are exposed to at least two different stimuli, imagine like a red light and a green light, but reinforcement for response is available only in the presence of one of the colors. For example, only if red is on, not when green is on, or vice versa. In a case like this, the stimulus that signals the availability of reinforcement is referred to in the sort of shorthand of the textbook and all the papers we're going to read and the rest of these slides as S+, and the stimulus that signals a lack of reinforcement is going to be S-. So it's important to keep track of what the difference between an S+ and an S- is in your head going forward. Initially, in stimulus discrimination training, organisms will respond pretty similarly to S+ and S-, and as they learn that S- does not predict a reward, they'll eventually decline in their responding to S-, especially as responding to the S+ persists. So stimulus discrimination procedures are going to establish stimulus control by the stimuli that signal when reinforcement is available versus those that signal that it is not available. So once our S+ and our S- have gained control over behavior, they're called discriminative stimuli. Now I'll go ahead and advise you to take a little break here, and we'll come back. I'll come back in however quickly you want, but you could come back in a few minutes, and we can dig into the procedure for stimulus discrimination training. So if you like, pause this, do something else for a minute, come on back. If you're ready to keep going. We're talking about stimulus discrimination training procedures. They, again, are rather straightforward. You're going to develop a paradigm in which animals are reinforced only to one stimulus. I'll go ahead and move forward in these by saying, let's say you reinforce to a green light and you don't reinforce to a red light. I think I said the opposite a minute ago, but let's do it this way so that it makes sense to what we typically understand green and red lights to mean. So I was asking, what's actually learned then in discrimination training? A critical question for us moving forward. And I think the best way to answer that is actually to reframe the question a bit, so I'm going to ask it slightly differently. I'm going to say, which strategies could a subject use to make sure that most of its responses were reinforced in a particular situation? So out of these three possible ones. I think there are three, the question is, which will they choose? Number one, a subject could learn to respond whenever S+ is present and then not bother to learn anything about S-. In this situation, an animal would respond only to S+, and they would get all the reinforcers. You'd hit the lever when the green light came on, and you wouldn't really even notice the red light in this particular response pattern, this learning pattern. Number two, learner could learn to suppress responding during S- and not learn anything about S+, sort of the reverse idea. You could press the lever normally all the time, you wouldn't need to learn anything about the green light here because you'd be lever pressing like normal, but then you'd learn that there's no need to lever press during the red light, and so you might stop. And so in this case, you would still get all the reinforcers by learning only this version of the truth. Or this third interpretation could be that a learner learns the significance of both the S+ and the S-, and they learn to respond to S+, and they learn to suppress responding to S-. So moving forward, we want to try to figure out which of these three is the truth. Is there one that is true all the time? Is it possible that in different situations, different animals might use one or the other of these different methods of learning, and if so, how is that organized? So in 1936, Spence designed a theory based on the third of these explanations, that an animal learns the significance of both the S plus and the S minus. They learn to respond in the S plus condition, and they learn to inhibit responses during the S minus conditions. And so that differential responding to S plus and S minus is going to reflect both the excitation of responding to S plus and the inhibition of responding to S minus. We'll investigate this theory as we have all the others we've talked about this semester by trying to figure out how you can experimentally evaluate this theory. Because the observation that organisms just respond more to S plus than S minus is not sufficient to prove that they've learned something about both. As we already discussed, it could be either of those other two possible situations, that they only learned about one or they only learned about the other. We need a more sophisticated test. We need maybe stimulus generalization gradients. So, if an excitatory tendency has become conditioned to S plus, then you should expect a steep generalization gradient. You should see high stimulus control, you should see the most responding to S plus, and a quick drop off in responding as the difference between the current stimulus and the original S plus increases. And this would be an excitatory stimulus generalization gradient. On the other hand, if an inhibitory tendency has become conditioned to S minus, then you should see a very similar but inverted stimulus generalization gradient. You should see that the animal is very effective at inhibiting stimuli that are really similar to the originally trained S minus, but that stimuli that differ are increasingly less effective as the difference in the stimulus increases, the difference between the current stimulus and the original S minus increases. When Spence proposed his theory, these behavioral techniques didn't even exist yet, so pretty remarkable that he had this idea before anything could be properly tested. And we're going to see that his ideas were substantially correct, which is pretty amazing. Imagine writing a theory with no ability, no methodological capacity to test your theory, and then having other people test your theory once the methods are developed decades later and still being right. Pretty high praise for Spence's intellect here. So in a big landmark experiment done by Honig in 1963, two groups of pigeons were trained in a discrimination paradigm with visual stimuli before tests of stimulus generalization. So one group was reinforced for pecking when the response key was illuminated by a white light with a black vertical bar. So I'm on slide 19 here, and you can see the exact middle of the figure, the exact middle of the picture that's pasted in here, degrees of tilt of 90 is that S original S plus. And so the pigeons were not reinforced when just the light was presented with no black bar in the middle of it. The second group, a whole different group of pigeons, got the same stimuli, only the roles were switched. The white light with the black bar was their S minus, and the white light alone was their S plus. After the groups learned to respond more to their group's S plus than their group's S minus, Honig et al. Ran tests of stimulus generalization by rotating the vertical bar. And so the question is, how much control does the vertical bar have over the pigeon's behavior? So you see the various levels of tilt here that show you what they showed the pigeons. So on the next slide, we have the data. Group 1, the one for whom the S plus was their vertical bar, responded, of course, in the presence of it, and then during the generalization test, they had the highest rate of responding when the bar was presented in its original vertical position, and progressively less as the bar was tilted more away from vertical in either direction. And so we see a really nice excitatory stimulus generalization gradient. It looks like they didn't test any birds on this graph at 60 degrees of tilt, but I think that's just a little error where the point is missing itself. You can kind of see where the line between the 90 degree dot and the 30 degree dot turns, and that would be where we'd place an empty square if we could edit this figure. So group two were trained with the white light as their S plus and the white light with the vertical bar as their S minus, meaning that they shouldn't peck when they see the vertical bar, and they did not. And they have this really nice inhibitory stimulus generalization gradient where they inhibited their pecking when the main vertical bar was present, and a little bit less so when the 120 and 60 degree bars were present, and less so as the bar became less and less vertical. So this is really nice evidence that discrimination training can produce both excitatory and inhibitory conditioning and excitatory and inhibitory stimulus generalization gradients, which is really nice support for Spence's theory of discrimination learning that animals do learn both sides. They learn both to the excitatory side and the inhibitory side. So far, I have describe the general characteristics of stimulus discrimination training under the assumption that what subjects learn about their S plus is pretty much independent of what they learn about their S minus. And it turns out that that assumption is far too simplistic. Learning doesn't fit into neat little compartments like that, especially, and as they usually are in the real world, if your S plus and your S minus are related in some way. For example, if they only differ by like one attribute. I'll give you an example of what this looks like. We call this intradimensional discrimination. So an intradimensional discrimination has to do in the real world with the problem of expert performance, which typically involves making some kind of subtle distinction, knowing a very slight difference between one stimulus and another. So distinguishing stimuli that only differ in a single feature is, of course, always going to be more difficult than distinguishing stimuli that differ in many features. And so the example on the slide here is that you don't need to be a car expert to know the difference between a smart car and a school bus. On the other hand, though, you might need quite a lot of knowledge to tell the difference between one BMW and another that's on the slide here. The fewer differentiating or distinguishing features there are, the more difficult that discrimination task is. And so that makes this kind of task really interesting for psychologists studying learning. Hansen, in 1959, showed how important this kind of intradimensional discrimination learning is by doing a study similar to an example we talked about before, training pigeons to peck in the presence of particularly colored lights. So all of Hansen's pigeons were trained to peck in the presence of a 550 nanometer light, so they all had the exact same S plus. 550 nanometers, by the way, is pretty yellow-looking, maybe a tiny bit green. And as you go, I believe as you go lower, yes, as you go lower in wavelength, you're going to get more toward green, and as you go higher, you're going to get more toward orange. And so Hansen grouped his pigeons, or rather differed his groups of pigeons, and how similar the S minus was to the S plus. And so the question here is how much expertise did these pigeons have to develop? Because some of them had to make really small differentiations, and some of them didn't have to make such small differentiations at all. Some of them were comparing two BMWs, some of them were comparing smart cars to school buses. So one group was trained with an S minus of 590 nanometers, so 40 nanometers away. Another was trained with a S minus of 555 nanometers away, so very, very close to the original of 550. And then there was a control group that had no discrimination training. They were just regularly reinforced for at the 550 nanometer wavelength, just to see what the sort of control groups generic stimulus generalization gradient would look like to see if the gradients for these other pigeons differ at all. And so after training, the birds were all tested for their rates of pecking in the presence of various colored stimuli, as you can see in the figure here. And so the control group is in the darkest line in the filled-in squares, And you see that they had the highest rate of responding to the original stimulus, 550 nanometers, and they responded less and less to other lights as the difference in wavelength from the original increased. So they have the typical gradient. You see them displaying this a pretty classical stimulus generalization gradient here. So our goal is going to be to compare that to our other two groups. So for the group whose S minus was 590 nanometers, we're looking at the line with the tighter dots and the open squares. They pecked a lot at the original stimulus of 550, and they had surprisingly even more generalization to the 540 nanometer color than to the original. So they pecked even more often to a color that actually wasn't the original color. They've shifted their peak of responding away from their original S plus, which in the first instance might seem surprising, might not even make sense. The 555 nanometer group, that is the group for whom their S minus was 555 nanometers, showed an even more dramatic shift to their peak. Their height is also at about 540 nanometers, but their second most frequent responding light wavelength isn't even the original of 550. It's down near 520. And so there's a very dramatic shift away from their original S+. And it doesn't really make sense at the outset that the birds would respond more to these other colors because they were never reinforced before. There's no reason that these pigeons should have been responding more often to these slightly greener lights because they were different than the original. Why would you respond more to a light you'd never seen than you did to one that you already knew produced some kind of positive reinforcement? Seems strange. And this is the heart of the phenomenon of peak shift. So peak shift is a result of intradimensional discrimination training because it did not occur for controls. It only occurred for those that got a specific kind of training here, being that discrimination training in which only one thing is varied between one stimulus and the other, in this case, the wavelength or the color of the light. So the peak shift effect was a function of the similarity between the S minus and the S plus used in the discrimination training. And what we saw just now was that the biggest peak shift occurred when the S plus and the S minus were very similar, right? So the group whose S plus was 550 nanometers and whose S minus was 555 shifted their peak even more than any of the other groups, and then certainly more than the group whose S minus was a bit further, was 40 nanometers away from the original 550. Now, it turns out that this kind of effect can be found, it can occur for any intradimensional discrimination. Researchers have tested things like color, as we've just seen. They've tested pitch of a sound. They've tested orientations of lines, as we were talking about earlier. They've tested volume of sound, the size of an object, the positions of objects. It's a robust effect. You can find it in so many different ways and places. But still, the question remains of how. How is this happening? These excitatory generalization gradients should peak at the S+. It doesn't make sense for them to peak anywhere else. The animals have never been reinforced for anything but the original S+. It's this really interesting and unexpected finding. And so it turns out that we can explain it in terms of the standard excitatory and inhibitory gradients, and actually based on the work originally done by Spence. So he's our galaxy brain example here, now on slide 25. He remarkably proposed this idea more than 20 years before peak shift was discovered, 20 years before gradients of excitation and inhibition were ever experimentally demonstrated. So a remarkable, remarkable theory developing here. So what Spence actually wrote was that because the S minus and S plus are similar in intradimensional discrimination tasks, so they're both colors or it's different volumes or whatever it may be, the generalization gradients of excitation and inhibition will overlap and interfere with one another. And the degree of overlap will depend on the degree of similarity between your two stimuli, your S plus and your S minus. And so because of the overlap, the inhibition that you've generalized from S minus is going to suppress your responding to S plus and shift the peak of the S plus excitatory generalization gradient. You'll see more inhibition from S minus to S plus will occur if S minus then is closer, because they'll have two peaks that are right near each other, and so that'll produce a greater shift in the peak of excitation. The peak shift effect is this, again, curious, counterintuitive outcome of intradimensional discrimination training. Even with this effect, though, discrimination training drastically increases the stimulus control of a behavior. It limits generalization of a behavior from S plus to other cues and increases the steepness of generalization gradients, which raises interesting questions for follow-up. First being, are there learning procedures that have the opposite effect? Can you find something that does the opposite of a peak shift? Can you shift an inhibitory peak? Are there learning procedures that increase stimulus generalization, on the other hand? We've looked at things that that move it around. Can we just increase generalization? How might we construct procedures that look something like that? And so in a normal discrimination procedure, the stimuli are typically treated differently in that they have different consequences. So one is associated with reinforcement, the other's not, right? So they have different consequences. The learner and the trainer are both going to be treating those stimuli differently, which leads to differential responding. So the question that I have for us moving forward is, what would happen if two stimuli were treated in the same fashion? Another word for the same is equivalent. What if they were trained in equivalent fashion? Would such a procedure lead an organism to respond as if they were equivalent or not? The answer actually does seem to be yes, and equivalence training is the term here for this encouragement of generalized responding. So you actually can relate to similar stimuli both in an excitatory way rather than having them compete in this peak as they do in this peak shift phenomenon. So there are several approaches that researchers have found promote generalization among stimuli. For example, pigeons can be trained to respond in a similar fashion to different photographs, as long as, or rather in the study that was published, the photographs all had included water in some form. So some had oceans, some had lakes, some had puddles, some had streams. But the basic strategy is to reinforce pecking in the presence of pictures with water and not reinforce pecking in the presence of pictures without water. So this is work done by Hernstein et al. In 1976. They had a huge number of photos. It was something like 600 or so photos of scenes in New England. And once the birds had learned the water, no water discrimination, they generalized that behavior to new photographs that they had never been trained on, which is really interesting. They learned the general concept almost and were able to apply it to new things. So that's the strength of the utility of the concept of training equivalence, which might sound like someone we've talked about before. You might remember our discussion of Chaser, Dr. John Pilley's dog, a few weeks back. Dr. Pilley and Chaser practiced equivalence training very often. They also, by the way, we were sort of marveling at how smart Chaser seemed. Part of the reason for that is that they trained about five hours a day, and they used a technique that you could go ahead and look up if you're interested, called fast mapping. All right, now that you know all about stimulus generalization and peak shift, you have the tools to listen to the Dunsmore presentation from this week, and you'll probably have an easier time figuring out exactly what they're writing about as you read it, as you reread it, rather. So one more time, welcome back. Hope this isn't exhaustingly boring to listen to the audio and flip through the slides. Get in touch with me if I can do anything to be helpful as you readjust. My email's the same, and I'm going to try to log on a few times a week, as you've seen in my previous messages, so that we can stay in touch. I hope to hear from some of you, and otherwise, I'll talk to you again next week. In the meantime, stay safe and healthy.